Hi, I'm Bill Kristol. Welcome to Conversations. I'm joined today by my good friend Jim Caesar, who's been a participant in these conversations a few times, and to the great benefit of all who have watched, I believe. Professor of politics at the University of Virginia, great student of American constitutionalism, and author of a very recent article, which I'd like to focus on and depart from today, on founding, the American founding, the idea of founding, the self-consciousness of the American founding, particularly focusing on James Madison. You say in this article, which people can read in National Affairs, summer 2018 issue, that Madison, more than anyone, served as the founder of the American idea of founding. And we say founding fathers all the time, or founding, what do we say now? We can't say fathers, founding
persons,
yes, humans.
I think would be right.
Anyway, so explain that. He's the founder of the American idea of founding. What does that mean? Why is it important?
Yeah, well, when we look back, we use these words founder and founding as if they're perfectly self-evident. After all, we had a founding, we had founders. There's no problem in using the word. Yet when you go back to that period, were they regarded as founders? Was that concept in existence? And I think the clear answer is no. Founders, to the extent it was used, or lawmakers, refer to the great practitioners of antiquity, like Lycurgus, founder of Sparta, or Moses, founder of the Hebrews. It wasn't in vogue at this period. And therefore, those people who went to Philadelphia in 1787, I'm not sure that the Americans in any way conceived of them or even thought of them as being founders. So Madison, and so you could say the Federalists, reintroduced the idea of founding. They took this old idea and put it now at the center of American politics, that they were founders. Madison compared the people at the convention to the founders of antiquity, mentioned all the founders of antiquity, and suggested that the Americans had improved upon the whole science of founding, and maybe that in the future, of course he had to be very delicate, the Constitution had yet to be approved, but I think he suggested that the American idea of founding might supplant the models that came from antiquity. So it was a very bold step that he took. So what I mentioned in the article is someone first had to reintroduce the idea of founding before we had founders in the modern sense.
And I guess, and you mentioned in the article, one could say, well, isn't the Declaration the real founding, the real foundation of the American regime? But there, I guess it's more ambiguous whether they don't really present themselves as founders, right? They're sort of required to separate from Britain.
Right. I mean, they weren't using the concept of founding when they put that out. So we use the term founders, but then when you ask people, well, who are the founders? They say, well, you know, they have no specific idea. I suppose if you press them, they probably would tend towards the founders who wrote the Constitution, 1787, 1788, though a good case could be made that we collapsed three groups of people. The ones who were instrumental in the Revolution, say Washington, Franklin, Jefferson, and Adams, who were, you know, perfectly discussable at the time of July 4th. I don't think there's any problem in introducing them. The ones who wrote the Constitution and who publicized it. And then probably as well, the ones who were involved in the first administration of Washington, which in a way completed the founding, introduced some new twists on the founding, and gave us the Bill of Rights. So those would be the three moments, right, if you press people. But I think the privilege place probably still goes to those who wrote the Constitution.
Which is striking when you think about it, since 1776 is the birthday of the nation, not
right,
1787 or 89. So, you
know. Yeah, I think a case could be made for all three, and I don't think Americans, you know, quibble. There were those who separated the Constitution from the Declaration and said, well, the Declaration is the true founding. The Constitution is either an improvement or a deviation. For example, the progressives. Declaration, great, a great democratic moment. Constitution, big mistake, took us in the wrong direction, protected property too much, introduced far too many checks and balances. We can get rid of the Constitution and go back to the Declaration, which I suppose would suit Jefferson quite fine.
But I suppose that, in a way, Madison's self-consciousness about founding does suggest you can't just have a, not that it's just, but you can't have a declaration, as wonderful as it is, you can't even have a revolution as successful as it was, unless you successfully found the government.
Right.
No one thinks of the authors of the Articles of Confederation. They don't get to be in those privileged groups of founders, whoever they were. I don't even know.
John Dickinson, as a matter of fact,
fine person, I'm sure.
Yeah, but there's no monuments that I know of to John Dickinson.
So that is an interesting point, right? That, I mean, yeah. I hadn't really thought about it. The government is, you need the government, has to work.
Yeah, I think that was what the people 1787 and 88 claimed, that they look back on the revolution and praise them as great heroes, but they establishing a government that could effectively institute the goals of the Declaration was their task, if they could accomplish it, which they did, which made them, in a sense, founders.
So they said or thought in a way that they were founders, but okay, so talk about the implications of that in terms of...
Okay, so this is suggested by Madison, that we now have this group of people who perform the function of founding, akin to all the people I mentioned of antiquity, who Madison mentions and discusses. So what was important about founding? In classical political philosophy, I think you could say it was the center of the study of political science. In a way, founding was the key point to which all looked, beginning, say, with the Republic, where in a way it has the idea of founders, but in Plutarch, it's central. So why is this the case? I think it's that, in a way, this idea that you can found, it suggests that there's some science of government that the human mind can achieve, that one mind or several minds can understand, and that this can become the basis for setting up the most important thing inside of politics, which is the political system in which you live. So if you take Lycurgus as an example, and I know the people from Michigan State will be happy to go back and understand what that statue of Sparty really means, but if you go back, Lycurgus is the one who performs the function of founding, but before doing so, in a way, he becomes one of the first students of political science, since he has to leave Sparta, he travels around the Aegean, and he meets a philosopher in Crete, Thales, who is already beginning to develop the idea of a science of politics, of what's best, what kind of regime would be best. And he studies some with Thales. So you could call that person, the one who has the general ideas, a kind of proto-founder, because he's not actually doing the business of founding, but he's laying forth some of the principles. And Lycurgus takes the best from Thales, comes back to Sparta, which is in a situation of crisis, and performs this magnificent task of founding Sparta, which is the most complete founding one could imagine in practice. I mean, even Madison says it's the real center of antiquity. Everything in Sparta is devoted to accomplishing some political task of making the members of Sparta look like they're Marines, putting the country before everything, great soldiers, great benefactors, and of course anyone who's seen the movie 300 recognized that they had great pectoral muscles as well.
Right.
So that's the importance of founding. So political scientists then say, if you understand founding, you can understand what sets in motion a regime and what's most important inside of politics, the regime and its different characteristics.
But Madison stresses founding in his founding. I mean, he could have done it, but not worried about the term and just been a politician who was adjusting things so they would work better and so forth, right? He seems to want people to think about the founding as a founding.
I do. Not one reason, a self-interested reason you could say, is so that people will see the founders as great. I mean, the notion of founding is connected with greatness. We remember those people of antiquity as the key political figures, so why not the Americans? Why can't they perform this role as well? So that would be the self-interested idea. But I think the founder is also connected with the idea that if something is founded, it's going to be founded for a long time. It's going to endure. And that's another question we can come to in a while. Did the people who founded America, or the Americans at the time, regard the Constitution as something that would endure? Was that what a written Constitution was, something that would endure and people would revere? Or was it just something that would be put in place for 10 or 15 years, respected as supreme law while it was in place, but then changed 15 years later? I think that was the, by the way, that was the dominant understanding of what a constitution was at the period. A written constitution is a kind of law, a little bit higher than other law, but would pass and change with time. And therefore, if that's the case, the founders would not continue to be remembered. They wouldn't be founding. They would have founded something that lasted for 15 years. We would have had another version of it, and people could have looked back and say, oh yeah, they had some good ideas at the beginning, but they didn't create something that has endured for a long period of time. That's one of the characteristics of a successful founder, is that they succeed, not that they try something and it fails and distinguish themselves for being a footnote in history, which is, oh, some five people tried this in 1787, but it never really worked, on to what occurred. That's not what Madison was looking for, to establish themselves as key figures.
And he argues, doesn't he, in the Federalist Papers themselves, that having reverence for the founding, if not for the founders, but for the Constitution certainly, will help make the Constitution work, so that founding, how should I put it, an understanding of founding or an appreciation of founding itself becomes helpful to the success of the founding.
Right. So you could say, what techniques did our founders introduce that the ancients didn't? One of the techniques or instruments they have is a written constitution. So a written constitution, everyone says written constitution, very important. Americans, beginning with the state constitutions, kind of reinvented the idea of a written constitution. Britain doesn't have a written constitution. And no one really did in 1787. There were no bodies that sketched out the character of government that were on a higher plateau than ordinary governance. That's what a written constitution allows you to have, to establish, as powerful as the rulers are inside of our system, they're always in theory subordinate to this thing called a written constitution. But the question really is, the main question is, what the heck is a written constitution? And I mentioned this before, and I can go back to it now. If you look at how a written constitution was viewed at the time, it wasn't an idea that the document that produced would be revered, would be venerated, would have some symbolic significance. Not at all. In fact, look at our state constitutions today. They're constitutions in every sense. They have people who wrote them, very few of whom are regarded as founders. Are they respected and revered? Would any sensible person revere, say, the Constitution of California, of sound mind and body? I doubt it. So it's not intrinsic to the idea of a written constitution that it will endure and that it will be venerated and revered. That's Madison's idea. And in this, he differed from Jefferson, one of the few points on which they differed. But Jefferson had proposed this idea that a written constitution would be revised every 15 years. It would be the highest thing while it was in existence, but could be changed and altered as time went on, and human beings would know more with progress. And he made fun of this idea that anyone would want to establish a constitution that's venerated and revered, mocked it as something akin to people who would believe in the Ark of the Covenant, and just as we have here in Washington, the Archives Building is a kind of ark. It's called the temple. You go up the steps. There's the parchment there, and you see it. It's meant to be revered. That was not part of how people saw a written constitution. That was what Madison helped to create in the Federalist Papers, seeing a constitution in this light. So I think that was probably, along with the idea of founding, the most significant thing about the whole founding enterprise was, what is the character of a written constitution?
I suppose that's what drives, in Federalist 49, the rejection of Jefferson's notion that let's just have referenda when there are disagreements about
exactly
what the Constitution means, disagreements between the branches, and then judicial review, which sort of elevates the Constitution and so forth. So it's an important part of our actual system.
It's really important, and it's not the tradition that we have in most of our state constitutions. Some of them have endured, but most of them have been changed several times. Some of them even demand that they be looked at and revised after a certain period of time. It's a whole another understanding of what a constitution is. This is an idea they think that came to Madison probably during the convention debate itself in response to Jefferson's idea, which was proposed at the time in the Notes of the State of Virginia, which was being circulated. that this is how people would look at a constitution. And Madison steps back and says, that's not how we want to look at the Constitution. We want to look at it in a different way. So he uses these terms in Federalist 49 of veneration and reverence, something we can look to. And in fact, I have to admit that my license plate is Federalist 49. That's very important for those who tailgate on the highway. They come right close.
You were the first person to call my attention to that.
Yeah,
the real importance of that paper, which really is central,
So, you know, you could say there's something to be said for Jefferson's point of view, but something very much to be said for Madison's point of view of the significance of this. Transformation and understanding of what a written constitution is. A written constitution is something old, looked at, and venerated, and hardly changed very frequently, not changed very frequently. There's a British political writer of the 19th century, Walter Bagehot, who introduced a nice little distinction. He talked of two parts of a constitution, referring to Britain, which has no written constitution, but kind of has a tradition. The dignified part and the efficient part. So the efficient part is the part that functions and works every day, the prime minister, great guy, important powers. The dignified part is something that which the people can identify with in a visceral, emotional sense, something that makes them feel British, something that makes them tear up or cry or feel that sense of patriotism.
Above party,
which is the queen. So the queen's the dignified part. So in a way, you're looking back on America, you could say, what's the dignified part of the of the Constitution of the United States? Is it our head of state? Well, sometimes not. I don't know how dignified one considers the current president versus past presidents. They're a partisan figure in part. The dignified element is the Constitution itself. And people can identify with the Constitution and what it means. It's a pretty funny thing in a way. You got this document, which is short, but still filled with ordinary language of powers and whatnot. What's really to venerate about it when you think about it? Just ordinary law. And yet Americans do venerate it, even if they never read it. They are aware of the idea that they should venerate it. And it serves this function of keeping people together, along with the Declaration. These are sort of fundamental documents. And so what you really have here are two different ways of looking at the world, the Jeffersonian way of looking at the world, which is we don't venerate anything. The spirit of veneration makes us those who are trapped by the past. And he makes fun of founders. What did they know that we don't know better? I was one of those, and they weren't that great. Of course, he's referring here to the Constitution, not to the Declaration, which he wants to endure forever. But leaving that point aside, things will change, and people will look at politics in a strictly rational way. And that's his hope, and give some good reasons for it. So Madison's view that he develops in now the second phase of the written Constitution, his idea is that we will look in part at the past and take what the past says with the greatest amount of seriousness and up to a point revere it. So in a way, you look at the world in a more, I'd say, traditional way. And people can come back. Even if you take Lincoln, who speaks of the principles of the founding, he always speaks of our fathers. Maybe when people start thinking of our fathers, they're in the language of veneration. A father is something you're at least we used to venerate. I'm not sure this case anymore, but that would be that. And he speaks of the importance of the founding, going back to that period. And so the American mind becomes in part structured by this thing which I would say restrains this impulse to change and to rearticulate something in a progressive fashion, that the Constitution should always be changed or revisited. It's a restraint on that, which I think is critical to what it means to be founder. So it would be hard to have a founder in this sense unless you had this notion of founding. I think it would simply dissolve the idea of founders. They're all part of a bundle that fits together.
So the self-consciousness about founding is necessary for the regime to not simply be progressive, let's say, and move on to whatever the latest fashion is, that it checks that, right?
You know? Right. And this would be, I mean, you could say, well, it's just one essay in the Federalist that Madison wrote. Fair enough. But this idea was picked up by the Whig Party in the 1830s and 40s, who really stressed this idea of veneration and looking back to the founders. It was stressed by Lincoln. It's stressed in our monuments that develop. And in a battle that develops over how much should we revere the founding between the progressives and the anti-progressives, and in our monuments here in Washington, what should they look like? Should they convey that feeling of a little bit of awe, or should they just be regarded in a practical way as something we move and shift like we change our clothes?
But I also think, don't you think, that Federalist 49, which lays the basis for Federalist 78, really, and for judicial review, I mean, that's sort of the practical way in which the founding is kept above the public. You look up to the Constitution, you look up, hopefully, to some justices who interpret it and don't simply do so in a partisan way or in a adjusting to contemporary fashions. I mean, whatever they do or don't do in practice, in theory at least, rogue justices, you know, that actually is a functioning part of government that plays, in Badgett's description, what's the alternative for
efficient and dignified.
Yeah, plays a dignified role, you might say.
Well, it's the difference between how state constitution works and federal constitutions. State constitutions, the most common thing is an amendment. So if the people don't like what's in the Constitution, they amend it constantly. So there's no notion that this is a stable and limited body. You know, in the Constitution that Madison creates, you can amend it, but it's pretty hard to amend in our system. That's so. So without amendment, how is the Constitution in a way adjudicated? And what's in it, how is that decided? That begins to point to other institutions, of which the court is one. I believe in this case that, you know, maybe in the original view, each branch had some role to say, right, speaking in a constitutional sense, but over time, the judicial review has more and more usurped the idea that there's one special institution that interprets the Constitution, and that's the court. At any rate, that's what our law schools frequently say is the characteristic of the court, that it has almost exclusive interpretation of the Constitution wherever it wants, however it wants, which could be a distortion of the original view, but it does point to this characteristic. So you look at state constitutions, they're rewritten, they're amended, they're changed. It's another way, a completely different way of viewing what a fundamental document is.
And the Constitution, the federal Constitution trumps ordinary law. That's really key for the courts to be able to enforce that, which in turn elevates constantly reminds the citizens that, oh, the Constitution, that's above the mere. I mean, it's pretty striking when you think about it, that Congress passes something with sometimes big majorities, the president signs it, and the court says, sorry, that violates the Constitution.
It is pretty strange. I mean,
didn't happen that often in the old days, happens more now. But
right.
And a lot of it was about striking down state laws and kind of maintaining national supremacy, I suppose. But that's important too, actually.
Yeah, it keeps the idea that there's something higher than the government. It's a pretty extraordinary thing when you have these people who are so important and powerful, the President of the United States, the Congress of the United States, who have to bow on their knee to the Constitution when that's put before them. You have to obey the Constitution. I mean, the most striking example of this kind of came up was in the court packing plan with Franklin Roosevelt. It's true that what he did wasn't unconstitutional. You can change the size of the court whenever you like, and we've done it a few times in the past. And many now are calling for it to be done in the future. It's a new idea that will expand the court to 20 so we can counteract the Republicans packing the court, as they say. But what happened in that point was that Roosevelt, as powerful as he was after the 1936 election, and as much as he had a majority behind him, when this battle came and he suggested enlarging the court, Congress, which almost entirely Democratic, said no. And the people more or less sided with the court against their own wishes for this higher form of public opinion, which we can call constitutional opinion. So in America, you always have two levels of opinion, your ordinary opinion, like do you favor new immigration law? Do you favor health care? These are important laws. But then you have some law above, which is the constitutional law, which is always reminding people, you can't have any particular statute unless it's in accord with the Constitution, and you always have to follow the Constitution. That's a pretty strange thing that works within the psyche of Americans, and works really only at the national level, I'd say.
And 1937 is pretty amazing. I don't know that much about it, but he wins a massive re-election victory. Part of the victory is based on challenging or overturning these limitations the court's putting on federal power and on the New Deal. He proposes something that is technically constitutional. I mean, no one thought you, like you say, Congress can specify the size of the court, so it wasn't as if it was, you know, clearly violating something right in the Constitution. And nonetheless, there's so much, I mean, there were other things going on too, but there's so much of a sense that this violates the spirit, I suppose, of the Constitution, that there really is a much more pushback than you would think.
I would think, you go back at the time, and try and imagine what things were like. It's true that Roosevelt didn't do much talking to members of Congress. I think he thought he could just get it through pretty quickly. So he didn't lay the ground, as it were. And it's true, as you mentioned, that it would be constitutional to change the size of the court. But what American people saw in this was a thinly disguised plan to change the direction of the court to the whim of the president. And they said no to that.
Now, the court did change, actually.
It did.
In a way that's more
the
more
switch
respectful
in time that
right
saved nine,
more respectful,
as they say,
of constitutionalism, I suppose.
And, yeah.
Now, so the founding, so that side of the founding is sort of the, let's say, creates the reverence, the veneration, the elevation of the Constitution above ordinary politics, and that seems important for a regime to have staying power and be self-limiting in some ways and not just, you know, moving on the whims of the moment. So it's kind of anti-progressive, I guess one could, conservative maybe in a little C. But doesn't founding also, it also implies a kind of, that they were reasonable. I mean, that the founding is something intelligent, not just old.
Yeah, I would say that the founding, the idea of founding itself is anti-traditional. After
right,
all,
that's what's interesting, yeah.
Completely anti-traditional.
Rational planning.
Rational planning, the idea that the mind can devise what's best, the idea that you would introduce some science of politics, and Madison even says in Federalist 14, since we're talking about Madison, that we didn't look back to the past for our standards.
Right.
We had a respect for the past, but we didn't venerate the past. He even uses the word veneration there. We found what we thought was necessary, and we, the founders, were willing to take a risk and try something entirely new. And recall that the Constitution, as set up, was something awfully new in the history of the world in a Republican government, a new way of fashioning Republican government, the idea that Republican government would be more successful in a large territory than a small, a whole host of things like this, which were regarded by many as radical. And the more traditional position was with the anti-federalists who wanted to keep the state constitutions. So the anti-federalists in many ways appealed to tradition. So you have these different foundations which are possible in setting things up. Foundation is a first starting point in politics. One idea is that your foundation is what's old and ancestral. What we got from our fathers. We don't want to change what we got from our fathers. And that instills a certain way of looking at things. The other view is, what we got is from our reason. And while what in the past can be looked at, it's not dispositive. We have to look at what we think is best and be willing to change. So founding itself, I think, is anti-traditional. And Americans, in laying the course of founding and in revolution, of course, are anti-traditional. They speak of a new world order, new way of looking at things, novus ordo seculorum. They had to by breaking with Britain. And in many cases, going back now to the debates on the Declaration and the idea of having a declaration in 1774 and 1775, they say, what is the best foundation for a society? And many people say, well, of course, it's our British rights. It's the charters. It's the old things. These are safe standards that we can look at. And Adams and John Jay look at it, they say, well, those are fine, but if we're going to break from Britain, we're going to need a new way of looking at things, something that in which the foundation doesn't come from tradition, but comes from reason. And that's what the American experience is going to be about. And that, I suppose, is reflected in the Declaration, which finally appeals to nature And there's nothing more subversive of tradition than nature, which is the study of how things are, not how things have been practiced by custom. And so that's the decisive shift, makes our polity different than Britain. Some people have never liked that. There's been one old strand of conservatism that never really liked the Declaration.
Right.
Yeah, in fact, you could say that the United States started falling apart on July 3rd, 1776, that evening. Everything went downhill from then. But there's another part of American conservatism, which I think Europeans have never fully understood, which tries to say there is a way of having a new kind of conservatism, which is founded upon a rational basis, which doesn't look simply to our ancestors, but to reason. It's a different style of conservatism. And this is what makes Britain and the United States, I think, differ in many ways. Britain doesn't look at things in this way. Britain has no founders. Say whatever you will about Britain, there are no founders. I mean, there's some princes from old. There's the tradition, though, most importantly, that comes from the Germans in Germany, who then come to Britain and give the great tradition of Britain, and then the institutions that grow by accident, in part, but not by rational design. Rational design steps in from time to time to trim this great tree, take off a limb, but the essential character of the growth of political institution is not based on this idea of founding, but based on the idea of slow organic growth, which we try and tend and cut and keep in line, but with no pretension that we can figure out the whole and reestablish regimes in a new way. So as much as Americans are, owe a great deal to Britain, and we do, and our British rights are still pretty important, and things like that, I'll say. This is a decisive point of difference, is that Britain has no founding, America has a founding. And therefore, that's a huge difference between the two.
And I do think very distinctive character of American conservatism, that I do think that, as you sort of suggested, it's less traditional than British, and then European, continental European conservatism in a somewhat different way, with, you know, the throne or the church or national traditions which are appealed to. But American conservatism, while having some of that, does, because it reveres the founders, therefore reveres people who try to use reason and appeal to nature, it has a different
cast, right.
Yeah.
And even if you look at Madison's view of revering the Constitution, veneration and reverence suggests accepting something on faith, let's say. Not religious faith, but faith. So, but it's also the case for anyone who studies the American founding, you don't have to accept it on faith.
No, they have wrote all these Federalist papers.
That's exactly right. Yeah. For those who are interested, and that's a large number, you can always go back to and redo the founding in your own mind, because every document of importance remains with us, and you can recreate the founding. They left us, after all, this argument for a revered constitution appears in a book, The Federalist Papers, which is one of the most conspicuous appeals to reason that one could imagine, which sets forth the logic of the government. And you can go behind that to the convention notes and whatnot. And every generation of students, if they would only take advantage of it, can recreate the political science of the founders. So this idea of founding in America connects us to a venerated past, but it also connects us to a reasonable past, which we can avail ourselves of.
I mean, I suppose the convention notes were kept secret for quite a long time.
Right, until Madison respected it. I think he showed them to Jefferson, but never published until after his death in 1836, when a couple years later they appeared. But the idea was that they would not be appeared, and it's one of those few promises that was actually kept by Madison and others.
Yeah, and I suppose that also fits in the sense that that's a little bit too much seeing how the sausage is made, you know, and it cuts against, I would say, veneration. And I think in the I don't know much about it, but in the history of the scholarship, the convention notes are often used to say, well, it's a bunch of compromises, big state,
right,
small state. Look, they made a lot of mistakes, they changed their minds a lot. The Federalist Papers, in a way, gets presented as a little more of a
immaculate conception.
Yeah, worked out whole, yeah. You know, and this was reasonable here, and this is there. And then
that's
you look under the hood, it's a little different, but
Yeah, I mean, as great as the Federalist Papers are, and they are, you have to realize that they're always taking the side of the Constitution, maybe right. reasonably so, but we know when they left that the different founders, for different reasons, had real reservations and doubts of whether the Constitution would survive. Nonetheless, they thought it was the best option, so they presented that way, but we don't see all the objections that they might have had to the Constitution.
I mean, you emphasize Madison in this paper, but I suppose Washington had an important role there, too, the kind of self-conscious, almost, dignity and thinking of himself as he was not going to do what was done had been done elsewhere and stay in power when he could, and Cincinnatus and all that, that's a kind of
Washington
founding,
remains,
right?
I think, the most important founder in every sense. Not in the intellectual sense of writing the books, but if you take all three moments that I mentioned, obviously, Revolutionary War, he's the hero of the Revolution. The convention, getting the convention together, the idea of having a nationalist convention was very much supported by Washington. They had one of the early meetings at his house in Mount Vernon. So he was always a strong nationalist. At the convention, he was president of the convention, and he understood his role was to, in a way, be the dignified presence there and not to partake too much in the debate. Others could do that. Argument was beneath Washington.
Right.
And then, of course, as the first president, maybe in a more, some would say, partisan way, but setting forth some of the characteristics of the office of the presidency, and not just the presidency, the whole way that the government would work, things like being presidential. What do we mean by being presidential? We mean pretty much what Washington had in mind, careful about who you are, presenting yourself not only as a leader of policies, but in a way as the head of state in a dignified sense. So Washington is extremely important, and is extremely important to the early historians of the United States who saw something there, an opportunity. Can we identify this system with the most perfect man you could imagine? And that's George Washington. So he's the hero beyond all heroes. And I think that's fair. You could say that Washington, at the time of the convention and afterwards, was universally respected in the United States as no other leader has been, I would say, in the history of the world. Not even Moses. He had his rebellions,
right.
And others. He had a standing and authority which was, you know, close to being godlike. And the founders realized this. They realized that they were riding in part on the coattails of Washington. And Washington realized this, that he had to protect this thing called his dignity, which was like a little Uberman across from him. He always had to worry not only what he was going to do, but how this would affect his dignity, because his dignity was so important to what was transpiring in the United States.
And just a word about Hamilton, since you focused on Madison in this piece, but I've always personally had a certain partiality towards Hamilton, now vindicated by this, by the Broadway show, of course. And
right.
There's
no
popularity.
Unlikely that we'll have a Broadway show about Madison, who was a very small person, sickly, that has to be said, lacked charisma, as opposed to, you know, Hamilton with this striking vanity and energy. They were different figures. They were friends originally on meeting, at Mount Vernon. I believe that's when they first met with Washington, and always together on the nationalist project. And so I would say in many respects you could say, some might disagree, but that Hamilton's the greater mind in many respects, I believe. Though maybe less the political scientist than Madison, but maybe the greater mind. But at the convention itself, Hamilton was only there part of the time. He did lay out, I think, something Madison never fully understood, which was the executive. He gave that one speech on the executive, which I think endured even after he left the convention and came back at the end, Hamilton. But he laid out the idea of what the executive power was, which was murky somewhat for Madison, and Madison went along with this, so that's an important part. And then afterwards, it was Hamilton's idea that we had to have the Federalist Papers to defend the Constitution in New York, but he quickly recruited Madison, and there they were working together again for the project of the Constitution. Later they had a falling out, it's inevitable. They even argued over who wrote some of the Federalist Papers. That went on for a century. But I think we can take them at their early point as allies in a great cause, and each contributing something really significant to the American founding.
It does seem, just in the popular mythology of the founding, the fact that you have Washington and then you have Jefferson and Madison and Hamilton, each with their own distinctive characters and political characters to some degree, coming together somehow gives it a kind of, I don't know, it's collective, it's not individual like Solon or Lycurgus quite.
Right.
But in a way that's more impressive, or I don't know if it's more impressive, but it may be more suitable for democracy, but it is striking, I guess.
This was one of the questions was, speaking of founding, in the ancient view of founding, the founder was almost always one. So rather than many. There's no committee of founders.
Right.
It's always a person, a single mind. And Machiavelli speaks about this at length, that it's the work of uno solo, one person. And he excuses Romulus for killing Remus because how could you have two people doing it? So fine, he killed him, but he allowed for one founder. And when Madison tries to distinguish the American founding from the founders of the past, he mentions that the American founding is not the work of one, but of some. I think he probably meant some, meaning the leading figures at the convention, that those would be the founders in the future. So some rather than one. And he acknowledges that there are problems with some, because sometimes you can get disagreement and falling out. But there's advantages in some, in that if they can work it out, the more ideas are transferred from one to the other. So he counts that as an advantage. He really had no choice when they were presenting the Constitution. It was done by some rather than by just one. And it is true that Jefferson did finally support the Constitution, though in the background, giving all sorts of reasons why maybe you wouldn't want to support it in some ways. Adams supported it. He wasn't there. I mean, the fact that Adams and Jefferson weren't there allowed Madison to have the role that he did at the convention, because it was rather mild-mannered that he was able to play this role. But they supported it, as did Washington and Hamilton. So you had all the nationalists versus the anti-federalists. It's true, we don't remember the anti-federalists because they didn't succeed as well. But some of them were, you know, distinguished people and had thoughts. But never, I think, of the stature of the founders, and the main founders then, at the time of the convention, not afterwards when Madison rose in prominence, the main thinkers in America at the time would still have been Jefferson and Adams. They were the most distinguished minds at the time. They weren't at the convention, but they did support the Constitution.
I want to get to the present, but maybe just to stop for a minute on Lincoln, who actually, in a funny way, is more alone in, I think, popular mythology and maybe reality too, as the savior of the country and of the Union and of the Constitution, with some redefinition of it, perhaps. I mean, say a word about, I mean, he thought a lot about founding and refounding, it seems.
Yeah, he certainly
talked
did.
Talked about it.
Yeah, he talked about it in the Lyceum Address. He was the one who proposed at that stage, that was way before the Civil War, of going back to the Constitution and our fathers. The terms that he used was fathers, as the source of what will hold the nations together, to always respect the Constitution. I would say the Lyceum Address is inspired by, I've never been able to prove this, but it's as if it's Federalist 49 on steroids. Right. Madison suggests these things in a very gentle way, as Madison always does. Very difficult person to read, Madison, because he never asserts things. It's always diffidently asserted, but there's Washington asserting the need for civil religion, looking at
Lincoln,
and developing that. So that's early Lincoln.
And also the memories of the Revolution.
Memories, the blood.
More,
yeah.
Which is, I guess, implied a little in the Federalist once or twice, but
yeah,
not quite
they
emphasized
do.
That
it's
way.
Mentioned in Federalist 49 that they did something and that's important. Madison, or Lincoln, puts the emphasis on this. He also points out that merely books and isn't going to be the thing that connects right. you viscerally. So another understanding really of political science that's maybe a little bit left out of the Enlightenment view, the importance of raw emotion, which is always right at the surface in Lincoln. By the time that he gets to his refounding, you could say, it points to the fact that nothing is ever permanent. It's always going to have to change in some ways. I suppose you could say the progressive idea of the Constitution is true in the sense that it can never be kept exactly the same, as everyone realizes. And as much as you want to say it's the same, it's going to change, and that was the moment that it did change. But he always tried to connect the change to what already existed in the past and remind us of the Declaration and of the Constitution. And of course, more than anyone else, I suppose the credit goes to him himself, not the members of his cabinet who sort of fall off along the way, not the abolitionists around them, not advisors, but to Lincoln, who stands there as one great figure who preserves the Constitution.
And today we have the Constitution is designed to sort of moderate and overcome, in some ways, you might say, populism and progressivism, and those seem both to be quite strong here in America in the 21st century in different ways, but I would say you could characterize that as two of the major, the Democrats as progressive and the Trump Republicans as sort of populist of a kind. And so how stands the Constitution in your judgment? How stands the founding? I mean, the understanding of the founding and the respect for the founding?
Yeah, I'd say pretty high. Right at the end of the last administration, the Obama administration, two political scientists, very well known, wrote this book called Relic. So that was Terry Moe and William Howell. I think they're very good political scientists. I think the book is, a scandal in some ways, a bust. It argues for the Constitution as a total relic. And I think it would be how progressives would be standing today if Hillary Clinton had won. Namely, where were they standing at the end of the Obama administration? Congress is too old, can't do anything, should be set aside. The regime is really a presidential regime. We always have to respect the president. The Constitution is a relic. That's what it was. It's a rewrite of Wilson's congressional government. And it hasn't made much of a splash. I think I'll speak for Howell and Moe that they're probably happy that it was written and forgotten about. Because now, if you look at the Democrats switching sides, people are instrumental. They're always switching sides one way or another. There's a respect for the Constitution in return, as if how could we ever have thought anything other than the constitutional view? And they see the Constitution as some instrument by which to control or to tamp down the president. So they, in a way, building it up. And the Republicans, although very favorable to Trump, most of them, they still have some connection to the Constitution. They've always been more constitutional sort of party. So they, in a way, appreciate this. So whatever difficulties some say we're facing today, I think people realize that the Constitution is the thing that's helped us get through this period. And people will use it in different ways and distort it and change it. But the mere fact that they keep going back to it provides some solace. And I think if you look at how things have going, the Constitution has performed this role in the last 2 years, a kind of moderating role. Even the president pays his respects to the Constitution frequently in his speeches, and that's a kind of restraining force, I would say.
It's astonishing how Donald Trump has made liberals rediscover the virtues of fixed law, instead of a living Constitution limits on the executive, limits on arbitrariness, all these things they didn't seem to be very concerned about.
Right, and even tone, presidentialism and whatnot. I mean, I believe that the Constitution is so set up that most of the time it can succeed even if people support it for instrumental reasons. So most of the time they're against it, but when they see that it's to their advantage, they can be for it. They move back and forth strategically, and the good thing is you always find people on both sides, but not always. I think it's always important to have some people who look at the Constitution as it were on its own, independent of the circumstances. That's very hard to do since we're so pulled into the politics of the day, and everyone's more interested in the politics of the day than what was done in 1787 and 1788. But in fact, it sets a lot of the rules, and we forget about this all too easily since we're the beneficiaries of the constitutional procedures.
Yeah, it's really remarkable that, and here we are talking about the founders,
31 years, I think. I forget.
Is that right?
Yeah,
18?
I don't have the
41,
exact.
I think.
Oh, 41.
Yeah. Is that right?
18? Yeah, I can't.
There was something 42. I don't know. Yeah, no, it's pretty remarkable thing. And that doesn't really exist anywhere else, right? I mean,
not that I can think of. I mean, after all, this was the first important written constitution of the modern world. Others have adopted written constitutions, but they've changed them more frequently. And I don't think they it has this symbolic role that the Americans do have for their constitution. We're in a way very unique in this respect, very, I'd say, traditional in some in many ways, which others don't understand. And of course, in Europe, it's hard to say because you have a number of constitutions. You have the Constitution of Europe, which has never been ratified by the public, big problem for them. And then you have the separate constitutions, none of which has, I think, the same standing as the American Constitution. And others have pointed this out when they've come to America. They begin to see the importance of this document and the significance that it has inside of American politics.
And it was the significance that it was intended to have. That's what's really kind of astonishing.
I would say, if we take Madison seriously and what he thought as the Constitution was written, but also I think over the period of writing it, that these issues came up and he rethought things. And probably this idea of founding occurred to him more in response to Jefferson's idea than something he originally entered the convention with. Oh, we're founders. I don't think he was thinking in those terms. He probably thought we're founders like James Dickinson was a founder. But this idea occurred to him more and more, as then did the character of what a constitution was, not something just written for a little while, but written for the ages to come.
That's terrific. Well, thank you for this
conversation
and education on the founding. I think this conversation with you and the one I did a few months ago with Harvey Mansfield on the Federalist Papers together, I would say immodestly, I can say this immodestly since I didn't do much except toss up some questions, it really is a terrific introduction and more than an introduction to the American Republic. So, Jim, thanks so much for taking the time. And thank you for joining us on Conversations.